The United States has some of the worst prison conditions in the world and some of the longest sentences. The very point of incarceration in the United States is punishment. It's not to reform the offender or to educate him or to prepare him for life on the outside. It's simply to punish. That's why recidivism is so high. That's why crime rates are so high. If, for example, a drug dealer gets 10 years in prison, does the whole 10 years, and gets no training, education, counseling, therapy, or anything else, and then is released, what does he go home to do? He goes home to sell drugs, because it's the only thing that he knows how to do. It's no wonder the entire system is in a state of chaos. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. I write and speak frequently about issues related to prison reform and sentencing reform. I speak also about the human rights aspects of the American prison system and about how the United Nations considers the U.S. practice of using solitary confinement as punishment as a form of torture. In the federal prison system, which is supposed to be better than the state and local systems, hundreds of prisoners die from acts of violence every year. Others die of heat stroke because most prisons have no air conditioning, unless, of course, it's in the warden's office or in the guard booths. Medical care is worse than it is in the third world. The food is not meant for human consumption. The water is, in many cases, not drinkable. What happens when a prisoner wants to use his time constructively? What if he wants to get an education or kick a drug habit or alcohol addiction or learn a skill? What happens when he just wants to learn how to live as an independent adult? What happens? Literally nothing. There is no budget for these luxuries. You can't get an education beyond a high school equivalency certificate. You can't learn plumbing or electrical work or mechanical repair or anything else. There's no therapy to help you beat your addiction. Nothing. So when you're released, you're given a bus ticket and $50, and the rest is up to you. Our guest today has seen the ugliest parts of the American prison system. Sean McDonald has had a very difficult life. His mother committed suicide when he was 4 years old, and he was adopted. He grew up in the tough streets of South Boston, Massachusetts. He began taking heroin at the age of 16, and soon after, he was convicted of bank robbery. At the young age of 20, he found himself incarcerated in one of the toughest prisons in America, the U.S. Penitentiary at Lewisburg. He spent his 20s there. Upon his release, he was out of prison for one single day before committing another crime that saw him incarcerated through his 30s in the toughest prison in the state of Massachusetts. Four of those years were spent in solitary confinement. When he was released with that bus ticket and $50, the only thing he had to look forward to was homelessness and more drugs. But Sean McDonald did not want to become a statistic. He wanted to become a success. He straightened himself out, he kicked his drug habit, he worked hard, and he made a life for himself. That life is tough, but he's making it. We're very happy to have Sean McDonald with us today. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sean, I'd like to begin by asking you to give our viewers a short overview of your life. You certainly have not had an easy time of things. The universe has not made life easy for you. Tell us about why you've been arrested in the past, how long you've served in prison, and where you served that time.
I grew up in South Boston, the ghetto, the Irish ghetto in Boston. It's like a lot of people know where it is, I guess. Some do, some don't. But that's where I grew up. It wasn't a pretty place to grow up. Everyone had some type of trauma going on in their lives. When I was 16, I started using drugs. I started using IV heroin. I was shooting heroin in my arms at 16 years old. And it was basically to kill all the pain that I had inside of me from all the trauma that I was dealing with. And unfortunately, that led me to a wrong path. And I started committing crime and I started robbing banks when I was 16 years old. By the time I was 20, I went to the FBI indicted me when I was 20 years old, and I went to Lewisburg Penitentiary. I spent 10 years there. After that, I got out for one night, and then I went back and spent 10 years in the state system. When I was in Lewisburg Penitentiary, it was one of the worst places I have ever been in my life. First, like, when I was going there, we were getting airlifted out of Manchester, New Hampshire. So we drove up there. The guards opened the doors, let us all out of the van to get on the airplane. But everyone was asking where they were going. And when it got to me, they're like, Lewisburg. And everybody in the van was like, oh my God, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what? Why? They're like, ask him if it's the camp or the penitentiary. And I asked him, and he said, United States Penitentiary, Lewisburg. So everyone was telling me, listen, you're a young kid. That's a very violent joint. You gotta watch out for yourself. You gotta make sure you take care of yourself. Don't tell people how much time you have, because his life is, they don't like to see people go home, and they would love to mess your time up and stuff like that. So I got on the plane. I ended up going to Oklahoma for classification. 2 weeks later, I was flown back to Pennsylvania. And I drove up to this prison that was built like a castle. It still had a 100-foot smoke tower in the middle from when they used to heat the prison with coal. So as soon as I got off the bus, one of the cops there was like, oh, we just took a body out yesterday, meaning somebody got murdered. And I'm thinking, where the hell am I? The judge recommended that I go to Fort Devens, which is, it can be a low, a medium, or whatever, any type of level that you're on, you can go to Fort Devens, and it's like pretty much a medical joint, and you don't got to worry about stuff like that. But the feds overrided it and decided to send me to a penitentiary because I had a violent crime. While I was there, I realized that I was all by myself, just like John said. And, you know, those guys from Boston that claimed to, like, have my back, and They're all happy that I was there. But I had to show my paperwork first to prove I wasn't a rat. They give you a week to do that. I was fortunate enough to have a friend there that knew me, that knew that I was good to go. I got my paperwork. I gave it to them. But, like, there was incidents I ran into. Like, there's this group that they call the DC Blacks. They're a prison gang. And a lot of them are what they call booty bandits. Now, a booty bandit is someone that rapes somebody in prison. And one of them asked me if I was a boy, and he asked me what sexual, like, he said it in a sexual way. And being a boy is somebody that gives himself up, and that's what they do for the rest of their bid, you know? And I decided I wasn't going to be that. I was going to remain a man. And I had to go get a knife, and I had to unfortunately stab this person. It's not something I wanted to do. It's not who I am. I've never been in any violence like that in my life. But I wasn't going to let the other outcome happen. And I ended up going to the shoe for 18 months on that, and it's just like, there's no reform in that prison. There's no, like, they have a drug program in the feds, and if you're in a penitentiary, you can't do the drug program. You have to be eligible for a medium to do the drug program, and that takes a year off your sentence. And you get to get a year halfway house to go home to. We weren't eligible for that. And because I was in such a violent place, I couldn't keep myself out of trouble to get my points lowered to go to a medium. Because I always had to keep standing up for myself and defending myself the way I was. So, like, I decided to make a change in my own life. And I took off from Boston. I came out to Pittsfield, Mass. I got myself in a halfway house program that deals with mental health and drug addiction. I've been out of prison for 5 years now. I'm working on my GED, and then I'm going to have to go to driving school and work on that because I never drove a car in my life because I spent my whole entire life in prison. I spent from 14 to 18 in juvenile from when I first started doing drugs and everything. And then I spent 18 to 20 in the county jail. And then I spent 20 to 30 in the feds. And then 30 to 40 in the state. So I'm 43 years old right now. And I got a good amount of time out of prison going on for me. And I would like to keep it that way.
Amen to that. One of the first things that I learned on my very first day in prison, and you touched on this on your own, is nobody cares about you. Nobody is looking out for you. You have to think about your own nutrition, exercise, medical, dental. But is that even really possible? Is it possible to be healthy in prison? So tell us about your medical and dental care in prison.
Well, there was a time when I was in Lewisburg when I was sitting in the SHU. I had a bad stomach problem and I lost 20 pounds and it was really noticeable and I was throwing up. I had all types of like horrible symptoms and they didn't care. They didn't do nothing for me. They would send me down to the infirmary. They would tell me, we don't know what's wrong with you. And they would send me back to my cell where I'm locked down 23 hours a day. Now, at the time, I still had people in my life that loved me and cared for me and were there for me. So it took them to call Stephen Lynch, who at the time was a U.S. senator, and tell him what was going on. He was from South Boston also. So he called the prison, and he asked him, what's going on? You're not taking care of this kid. I heard he's very sick, blah, 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 and He lost 20 pounds, and I guess he needs to be checked out. So immediately after that, they started taking me out to the hospital, running me for tests. Turns out I had a bacterial infection called H. pylori from dirty trays. Because what they do with the trays in prison is they'll bring them to the kitchen and wash them, but they really don't get washed good. They stack them all together right next to each other inside the washing machine, and then they steam them clean. But like at lunchtime, if you had lettuce, when supper time comes, you could have lettuce still on your tray from lunch. So they weren't clean, they weren't sanitary, and you're right, John, like it's not possible to stay healthy in there.
That is absolutely right. I saw the same kinds of things. Not to that scale, of course, but the same things that you did. Okay, so my first full day in prison was fish day for lunch. But one of the other prisoners told me not to touch the fish because they called it sewer trout. When I got to the cafeteria, I saw these boxes that had written on them, Alaskan cod, product of China, not for human consumption, feed use only. And sure enough, this was animal-grade food. And in fact, this is the kind of food that we were fed every single day. It was meant for animals, not for people. We were even once fed dog food by accident because it was mismarked as taco meat. And the tragedy there was that we didn't even realize it was dog food. That's how bad the normal quality was. What was your experience in prison with food?
Mine was exactly the same. The juice they give you, the box that it comes in, has a skull and crossbones on it. It supposedly causes cancer. And that's the only thing you can drink with your meals is this juice that everyone is saying causes cancer. And in the state system, if you don't have somebody sending you money so you can get commissary, you're going to, like, die of starvation. You're going to lose weight. There's no way you're going to be able to be healthy and work out because they don't give you enough. They give you a little half a scoop of corn, a little half a scoop of, let's say, I don't know, a cake, a little small cake to come with it, and something that we used to call cow tongue, which was a square piece of meat that nobody knew what it was. And they served that most of the time. You're exactly right about the fish. That every Friday was fish. It was called Fish Friday. I didn't eat it. And it's just not for human consumption, but they don't care. The trays come pre-packed. They give them to the blocks. They pass them out. Like, State System didn't have a cafeteria or a chow hall like the feds did. They make you eat in your cell. So you just come out, get your tray, and then you go in your cell. So you could have peas, tomato sauce, maybe a small cake, and some cow tongue thing. And it's gross. You can't eat it. And the people that get commissary, they give out their extra trays. They don't ever eat that. You know, they don't want nothing to do with it because they don't want to catch nothing, you know. And I don't know. I always thought, like, my parents, when they were alive, they used to think that the prison provides everything for you. So, like, they didn't send me money because the prison told them. We feed him. We give him sneakers. We give him hygiene. When they don't give you none of that. You get a pair of Bobos that fall apart in a week. They don't feed you. You lose weight. You die of starvation. Every night you go home. Not home, jeez. I wish. Every night you go to bed with your stomach touching your back. The quality of the food is just horrible.
Sean, that's heartbreaking. Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Sean McDonald about the broader problems that American prisoners face in every prison in America. The system is broken, and it seems that nobody in a position of authority has any idea how to fix it. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Sean McDonald about his experience in the American prison system. Sean, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Sean, you were in two of the most dangerous and most high-security prisons in America. Tell us about security in places like those. What was life like on a daily basis? And did you trust prison authorities to keep you safe?
When I was in prison, I had no access to nothing to help me better myself. Like, there was no programming. There was no work. There was no way to earn money. There was no way to do anything. If you had mental health issues, they weren't getting dealt with because they didn't have the proper mental health staff. They didn't care about you. Everybody worked for the COs. The COs don't care about the convicts. So the nurses are with the COs. If there is mental health providers, they're with the COs. So they don't properly medicate people. They don't properly help people. Like I told you, people commit suicide all the time because you can't tell them that you're suicidal. If you do, they will torture you. And I went from 4 years in DDU to the street. I didn't know what to do with myself. I couldn't be around people. I went and got a haircut as soon as I got out, and I was so nervous and so scared. Looking around, I have people bumping into me. I'm not used to that. I couldn't even get through the haircut. And I went to my sister's house, and she lived in the project, so she had a little porch outside. And I used to always go out there to get away from everybody and sit there in a chair and just smoke cigarettes all day. And I wondered why that was so comfortable for me. And one day it hit me. It's like, this is like your own prison cell. You know what I mean? You're all by yourself in your own prison cell, and that's what you know, and that's what makes you comfortable. So that's why you keep running in here, because you don't like being around people, or running out here, because it's outside. So there's really no way to prepare someone that's going to prison on how to get themselves taken care of while they're in there. The best advice I can give is try to stay as healthy as you can. And I know you can't control that, but try and take care of your teeth the best you can, because they're not going to fix them. They're going to pull them. I don't know. Have your family members call the prison. Have your family members put in grievances, because they're not doing the right things that they should be for people. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, it shouldn't be the way it is, I'll tell you that. Like, I shouldn't have got 4 years in DDU for murder, which is what they found me guilty of, institutionalized, right? I shouldn't have lost 4 years of my life to solitary confinement to something I had absolutely nothing to do with. And I had no control over the situation, even though I was never arrested for it. They couldn't even get probable cause.
I also want to ask you about the absence of opportunities. You had no access to education, to counseling, to therapy, or to literally anything else to prepare you for life on the outside. In fact, you went directly from solitary confinement to freedom. How common was that? And what should prisons do to prepare prisoners for life?
Well, like I said, I had H. pylori while I was sitting in the SHU in the feds, which is the hole. They call it the SHU. It's 23-hour lockdown. You get an hour a day in a cage, a dog kennel. That's basically what they treat you like, a dog. You get 1 hour in a cage, and all you can do is walk back and forth, if you even get that. If you're not up at 4 in the morning and catch the sergeant going by your door and tell him you want wreck, and you got no alarm clocks, no nothing, you're not getting wrecked, right? But I had H. pylori. My stomach was so bad. I was throwing up. I had diarrhea. Everything was a mess. I lost 20 pounds. I was putting in all types of medical slips after medical slip after medical slip. I was asking the nurses when they came down, can you please tell me what's going on? Am I going to be going out for any tests? Does anybody know what's happening? And nobody knew anything. It wasn't until Stephen Lynch called the prison system and told them that he was concerned about my health that they started taking me to hospitals, and they found out the problem and they medicated me right. But I was lucky. Everyone else in there, they didn't have that. Like, people are lucky if they have anybody. They don't have people calling senators so that they can go get treated medically. Like, you should be able to get treated medically regardless. Like, that's what medical should be for. But they're there for nothing. They just collect a paycheck and they go home. And they cost people their lives. And with me, it was the H. pylori. Then I had something else going on with me. I forget the name of the condition, but it was in my lower body, and it took months for that to get taken care of. I had a hernia. It took probably 3 years to get the operation, and I was lucky they even did it. I was sick all the time because I wasn't eating right. I didn't have the fortune of somebody sending me money so I could have commissary. So I had to eat the trays. And if you don't follow it, you could get a night. You could bump into someone in the hallway and say, hey, excuse me, I'm sorry, I apologize. If you don't say that, you could be walking the hallway the next day and get a knife in your back, because the person could feel like you disrespected them. But back to medical, there was no medical. There was absolutely no medical. I was fortunate enough when I was in the state system, I didn't catch anything wrong with me, like the two things that happened to me in the feds. Nothing like that happened to me. I actually, one time I caught cellulitis in my leg, and I showed the nurse, and he gave me antibiotics, which I was shocked. That barely never happens. But he was a good nurse, and he ended up getting fired and walked off the compound for I don't know what. But he must have did something that got them mad. Maybe he was helping out too many convicts. Maybe he wasn't doing what they want him to do, which is nothing, you know. You would think in the prison system that they would have proper medical and, like, things for you to do in order to get your life better so you don't come back. That's why the recidivism rate is so low in Massachusetts, because people get out and they have no clue what to do with themselves, and they go back to drugs, you know, and then they end up back in prison. I was fortunate enough to just call it an end. Like, I couldn't do it no more. It was torturing me. I couldn't do time no more. I couldn't use drugs no more. I was just tired, you know? So I ran away, and I'm out here fighting for my life every day.
Well, God bless. I wish you the very, very best. Bernard Carrick is the former police commissioner of New York City. He found himself serving a prison term after a conviction for corruption. And when he got out of prison, he said this, and forgive me, it's a little bit long. Quote, "Don't promote yourself as a country of constitutionality and compassion if you honestly believe that putting people in prison and treating them like animals is justified. Stop all the hype that we live in a free and democratic society. I used to ramble on about the same stuff, but now, are we really a country that believes in fairness and compassion? I've met good men, yes, good men in prison who made mistakes out of stupidity or ignorance, greed, or just plain bad judgment. But they did not need to be sent to prison to be punished. 18 months for catching too many fish, 2 years for inflating income on a mortgage application, 3 months for selling a whale's tooth on eBay, 15 years for a first-time nonviolent drug conspiracy in which no drugs were ever found or seized. There are thousands of people like these in our prisons today, costing American taxpayers billions of dollars when these individuals could be punished in smarter, alternative ways. Our courts are over-punishing decent people who make mistakes, and our prisons have no rewards or incentives for good behavior. In this alone, criminal justice and prison systems contradict their own mission statements," unquote. I'd like to thank our guest, Sean McDonald, for being with us today. And thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack, @John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.